Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org, where audio and video links to past programs are also available. I am Peter Finch, an anchor and reporter with KGO Radio, and I will be moderating tonight's program. Before we give a warm welcome to our guest tonight, I want to tell you a little bit about him. His name is Peter Coyote, and he's got a really cool resume. You may be somewhat familiar with it. Presumably you are, because you're here today, but actor, narrator of documentaries, writer, Zen Buddhist priest. Yes, all of these things. He was born in New York City, raised in New Jersey. As I understand it, went to college in the Midwest, was accepted to the prestigious Iowa Writers Workshop, but instead decided to pursue a master's degree in creative writing at San Francisco State University. And then things got really interesting. Not to suggest your childhood wasn't interesting. We'll find out about that momentarily. But I'll pick it up now with a script that they have provided me. San Francisco in the 60s seemed to be the perfect place for Peter Coyote, who rose to prominence as a leading figure in the Bay Area's counterculture community. In addition to joining the San Francisco Mime Troupe, a radical political street theater, Coyote became a founding member of the Diggers, an anarchistic group supplying free food, housing, and medical aid to the hordes of runaways who appeared during the Summer of Love. Mr. Coyote chronicles many of the stories of that period in his memoir, Sleeping Where I Fall, which he will sign tonight after the program. In the 70s, Peter served as both member and chairman of the California State Arts Council before returning to acting at the Magic Theater in 1978, while playing the lead in the world premiere of Sam Shepard's True West. A Hollywood agent pursued him and asked to represent him. 70-plus films later, Peter is still acting. Just flew back from Europe, where he's shooting a movie. Today, an avid outdoorsman and ordained Zen Buddhist priest who began a regular meditation practice in 1975, Peter continues to show concern for the well-being of the planet and all who live on it. His Zen studies have led him to examine the limits of human intelligence. He thinks wisdom should take a more prominent role. We're going to get into that tonight. That's going to be a big chunk of our talk tonight. And based on the discussion we were having backstage, it's going to be very interesting. Thrilled that you've joined us here today. Would you please join me in welcoming Bay Area icon Peter Coyote to the Commonwealth Club?
Thank you very much.
I guess my first question, because you're something of a Renaissance man. You've done so many different things. As a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
A cowboy. My dad raised cattle. Actually, my dad brought the first Charolais cattle. It's a big white French cow into the United States. We had a partner in Texas, and they were banned by the Hereford and Angus lobby. So my dad and Harl Thomas painted black spots on them and ran them across the Rio Grande as Holsteins.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Now, I understand if what I read is to be believed, that it was as a teenager that you first took an interest in Buddhism by reading Jack Kerouac and others of that ilk?
That's true. I was introduced, well, about 16, I ran across a book by Alan Watts. And then I was reading the Beat Poets and reading Gary Snyder and reading Jack Kerouac, and they talked about Buddhism. And I got kind of an intellectual conceit about it, and it seemed to mimic the way that I felt that the world was all of a piece. But I didn't really begin to practice Buddhism. I didn't know anything about meditating until the end of 1974. But I had that kind of intuition about the world.
Now, I want to talk about this journey that led you to San Francisco. You had been accepted to this prestigious program in Iowa. You decide to come to San Francisco State, major in creative writing. Was it the program or was it San Francisco that drew you here?
Well, no, it was actually the last three weeks of winter of my senior year where the temperature never got above 20 below zero. And I had spent 4 years in Iowa, and that was enough. And San Francisco seemed great. I'd come out here in 1959 to see the Beats. I went to the Coexistence Bagel Shop and City Lights Bookstore. But really, there wasn't the San Francisco that we think of yet. My first apartment was at Haight Street in Clayton, and it was kind of a nondescript working-class neighborhood featuring a transient population of UC med students. So the psychedelic shop opened about a year after I got there, and that's where things got interesting.
A friend of mine, Scoop Nisker, likes to say he came to the Bay Area to be a beatnik and got here too late and got assigned to the hippies. Is that what happened to you?
Well, I mean, I know Scoop. Scoop's a great guy. He got assigned to the hippies. I think Scoop's about as hip as they get. No, what happened to me was that I came here in an exploratory mode, and I began to see things that were unlike anything I'd seen in the East Coast or the majority culture. And once psychedelics hit the horizon, and there was this possibility of radically changing one's perceptions, that really opened things up, and it became a kind of line in the sand that made sense out of what we came to call the counterculture. All those posters of rock and roll shows where the inlines and the outlines were fused, they were basically kind of an admission ticket. If you'd had LSD, you could look at them and they'd make sense. And if not, it looked like a psychotic chimpanzee had been playing around with watercolors.
Now, I apologize in advance for this next question because I'm sure you get asked it all the time and you're probably sick of it. You were not born Peter Coyote. When did you become Peter Coyote, and how did you get that name?
So in 1962, some friends of mine and I sent away to Moore's Orchid Farm in Laredo, Texas, and we bought a box of peyote cactus about that big. And we didn't know much about it, but we were college students, and we thought, let's go to the library. So we went to the library, and by God, there in the library, we read about a peyote cult in Tama, Iowa. So we drove over to the Tama Indian Reservation, and for half of our peyote, an Indian guy over there showed us how to take it. So we went to a friend's room, and we all sat around, and we chewed these cactuses, which was kind of like sucking the moss off an inside of a well. And we just kept chewing and eating and chewing, and nothing happened. So my friend Terry Bisson stood up and he said, well, I'm going home. Nothing's happening. And he stood up and he said, hey, my hands are dizzy. And as soon as he said that, everything went and we were gone. I mean, we must have had 12 to 15 buttons each. So we went outside in this star shot Iowa night, and I turned to my friend. I said, something's weird, but I just turned into some kind of little wolf or something. I don't know what it is. And I spent the entire night dog trotting through the Iowa fields, just and I woke up in the morning standing in the mud. Well, you can't see my ring, but there's a little coyote footprint on that ring. At my feet were all these footprints in the mud, and I was still pretty whacked. I couldn't be sure if I had made them or I had just come to a stop here. So about 5 years later, I told that story to, I was living with this Shoshone Paiute shaman named Rolling Thunder. And I was fixing his trucks and fixing his toilets and stuff like that. And I told him this story, and he said, oh, well, so the universe opened its heart to you. What are you going to do about it? I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, you can treat it like a hallucination and you can stay a white man, or you could take it as an invitation and become a human being. White man, human being. So I thought, okay, that sounds good. And I thought about it for a while. And so I took the name Peter Coyote as the first step to understanding what it might have meant. And so I was about 24 then. I'm 71 now. So I've been Peter Coyote longer than I've been anything. But that was the genesis of it.
And your birth name was?
You like that. My birth name was Rachmiel Pinchas Mendes Bartolomeo da Silva Ben Moshe, from a long line of Sephardic Jews. My relatives still had the key to the house they were thrown out of in Toledo in 1492, in a kind of grand screw the queen gesture. They locked up the house and took the key.
We're off to an interesting start, aren't we, with Peter Coyote on tonight's Commonwealth Club program. And as was mentioned at the outset, I guess there are blue cards making their way around where you can write out questions, and those will be passed to me. And throughout the program, I'll glance down and maybe share them occasionally. Also, later on in the program, you'll have a chance. There's a microphone over here where you can go up and ask Mr. Coyote a question yourself.
Nobody calls coyotes Mr. Peter.
Yeah, I know. Mr. Coyote.
Mr. Coyote.
It did sound a little weird. When we have some cards ready to go, just go ahead and bring them up to me, and we'll start working those questions in as well. Right now, though, I'd like to turn to what has been introduced as the theme of the talk tonight, which is the end of intelligence. And yes, it was, you were trying to remember on the way over what you were calling it, right?
Yeah, I was so nervous. When I was riding here, I was stuck in traffic, and I was thinking, oh my God, did I call it the limits of intelligence or the end of intelligence? The end of intelligence sounds like the epitaph for a moron. I hope I didn't call it, but I did call it the
end
of intelligence.
You did call it that. Yeah. We'll move on, though, and not speak.
Yeah, we went.
Anymore.
He was stupid, and we left.
But whatever you call it, what do you mean? What are you talking about here?
Okay. So since we first cracked open bones to get the marrow and chipped flint and created javelins and learned how to heat wood in a fire to make a spear, we've been using this great bicameral mind to solve problems. And it's become a formidable tool. Some archaeologists suggest that it was our use of fire that allowed us to have small jaws, tiny intestines, and for all that energy to go into our brain. The problem is that you can also look at the dilemmas of the world we inhabit, and you can say that they're all products of intelligence. Nuclear pollution, global warming, automobile traffic and congestion, nuclear threats. I mean, start and stop anywhere, and you see that at the end of this long train of problems solved by intelligence, they've dragged with them these enormous shadows. And so the antidote to intelligence, or let's say the more inclusive perspective, is what I'll call, for lack of a better word, wisdom. I can tell you two things about the world that are mutually exclusive, but both true. I can tell you that every grain of sand is unique, every blade of grass is unique, every human being is unique, and you can't have an argument with that. You'll just say, yes, it is. And then I can also tell you that the entire universe is one interdependent thing, that we can't live without sunshine. We don't have an existence that's separate from water, from pollinating insects, from microbes in the soil, from microbes in our intestines that digest our food. So both propositions, every grain of sand is unique and it's all one thing, are both true. And the problem, the practical problem for us humans, is that when we think and communicate with language, we can only express one half of that equation at a time. So that everything we say is always half wrong. When I'm in the relative mode, I'm not bringing the absolute with me. Or when I'm in the absolute mode, I'm not bringing the relative with me. And it's wisdom, for lack of a better word, which always keeps an outrigger in the one that it's not in. so that when I'm creating some practical problem-solving invention, some part of an expanded mind has an outrigger in the wholeness of things and is being informed and instructed by that. When Henry Ford decided that it would be great for every person to have their own mode of transportation, he didn't know that we would be blowing up people in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, and that we would be carving up the landscape into highways, and we would be smelting coal to make steel. He just saw a practical solution to a problem. And he didn't have the shadow side. He didn't understand the shadow side. And there is nothing that doesn't have a shadow side. And the shadow side is the other half, the unseen half that is not attended by language. So at a certain point in my own life, I began to realize that I'm the problem. That as much as anything else, by not looking at my own anger, my own delusions, my own greed, my own confusion, I'm replicating all the problems in the world that I would like to solve. I'm putting evil out there. I'm putting anger out there. I'm calling it the Taliban or the Republicans or the Democrats or whatever, and I'm exempting myself. That exemption creates a shadow. So I made a decision at a certain point that there were plenty of smart people in the world, and we were never going to think our way out of this mess, that what was going to be required was inducing people to use their natural birthright of wisdom. You don't have to be a Buddhist. You don't have to be Jewish, a Catholic, whatever. A baby's mind, before it has a thought, is a perfect entity. And what we need to do is create space and calm and quiet to get into a place where we can think without words sometimes, where we can perceive the interpenetration of these two mutually exclusive opposites and reach a kind of state of wholeness so that we can consider our actions from that perspective.
Did you get that?
That's a mouthful,
Well, it's very intriguing. And I want to talk more to you about the wisdom side of it in a moment. Let's get to talk a little bit more about the intelligence. When these folks come up with these ideas, they go, okay, I'm going to invent the gas automobile or whatever. They must be really excited about it, you know, and go, oh my God, you know, I could make the world a better place and maybe make some money too. But do you think it's a case where then they get so excited that they don't even like pause to think of perhaps some negative ramifications from their invention or their service or whatever it is?
Well, what do you think? I think.
Well, having interviewed you backstage before, I know a little bit, but...
So what do you think would have happened, let's say, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, if Oppenheimer and the scientists said, there is no reason that this substance named after the devil should be promulgated in our culture? We can't control it. We're asking ourselves to be perfect. In a universe where people say oops every day, and they had just made a kind of taboo. And what a taboo is, if you think about it, is the wisdom to recognize that you have more power than you have ability to control what you make. So had they said that, we would not have tons and tons of nuclear fuel leaking into the rivers in Hanford, Washington, leaking into the Tennessee Valley Authority, all over the world, piling up, dumping into the oceans in Japan. Admittedly, their intention was compassionate and perhaps trying to expiate their guilt. But had they just stopped to ask themselves, we're creating a permanently toxic poison that's antithetical to anything with replicating cells. Are we sophisticated enough, capable enough, to leash this on the universe? I think wisdom might have had second thoughts and said, I don't think we are.
Now, a possible downside of that, do you think that there could be people who maybe would come up with a brilliant idea who, if they thought about it too much, would not bring it to fruition, and maybe we wouldn't have penicillin or, you know, things that are beneficial to society?
Well, in Buddhist practice, we say that everything starts from intention. That if you have a compassionate, generous intention, even if you're stupid, things will somehow turn out okay. But if your intention is selfish, you can't be smart enough to avoid the repercussions of it. So, you know, I can understand that someone pursuing a medicine, trying to save lives, it doesn't exempt us from the fact that it still has a shadow, right? If you save every life that comes into the planet, if you have that capacity, you're responsible to do that. Then you have the problem of overpopulation. Then you have the problem of human populations squeezing out the animal populations and the tree populations and the plant populations. So I'm not saying that you wouldn't do that. I'm just saying that you would have to put the whole thing in a matrix and realize there's no free ticket. Everything has a shadow.
For everybody listening to us today and enjoying this program, you know, maybe for them it's not necessarily an idea that's going to change the world, but it could change, you know, their family or people in their lives, big decisions, something they maybe think is a great idea, smart idea. Your suggestion when you talk about wisdom is to maybe put yourself in a quiet meditative state and think it through and really ponder it?
Well, my experience has been that if I'm not working on my character actively, I can be pretty sure that the world is eroding it. So for me, meditating is a space every day that I take for myself to get down to ground zero, to let my mind quiet down, to let its feverish little monkey agile trickery just slow down so that I can see the big picture of things. And when I do that, I realize that I've never for one instant been separate from the rest of the universe. So what is it that I think I really need? If I imagine myself standing on a cliff and looking at a little choppy ocean with all these little waves, I can imagine the little waves saying, oh, that one's so much bigger than I am, or I'm really cute, or that one's smarter. But you know, they're just like human lives. They rise up out of the ocean, and they fall back into the ocean, and they appear to be separate, but really they've never not been part of the ocean. And we human beings are the same thing. So we have this idea that we're separate, that we live in the relative. Every blade of grass is different. Every grain of sand is different. I've got this little kernel of a self in me that's separate from all of it. But it's an illusion. We've never not been part of the ocean. And just that perception allows you to let a lot of stuff go by, because what do you really need?
I think some of the things that you've said so far are going to maybe prompt some questions as we get, you know, into the live question and answer section a little bit later on. But we've got a stack of questions already, and I'd like to share some of them with you from our audience. What do you consider the most important spiritual movement of the 20th century?
Well, I have a bias, but I think that the growth of kind of Eastern traditions. I don't want to say just Buddhism, but Vipassana and yoga and Buddhism and the various sects of Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, Korean, Japanese. I think these have come at a time where they're going to soften North America. They're going to soften our kind of cowboy consciousness and our rugged individualism and feminize our culture a little bit so that we can become more receptive. And in that sense, I think that's a really important change on addition to European culture.
Another person in the audience wants to know if you prefer this to peyote, but I'm not sure. Do you know what that even is?
Ayahuasca.
Oh, okay. Sure.
The problem with all of it is that you come down. And the reason I became a Zen student is I wanted experiences that were chemical-free at the end of the day that I didn't come down from. I have nothing against ayahuasca or peyote or any honest spiritual exploration. And I learned things from all of them, but you come down. You don't have to do that. You don't require a chemical to get higher than you can possibly imagine.
I can't make out one word here, so I'll paraphrase this. Was there a defining moment in your life that brought you to where you are today?
Going to jail for marijuana smuggling when I was 17. I got caught with 8 kilos of marijuana in 1959. And this was the same year that they sent a Texas stripper named Candy Barr to prison for 15 years for having a joint in her bra. And luckily I was 17. So I was adjudged delinquent and I was not made a felon. But sitting in jail, I thought, oh, yeah, this is not a place to come back to. So I'm not saying that I've been legal and exemplary by any means. I was a drug addict for 12 years, but I never went back to jail.
Interesting. Peter, how do you think that the creative arts, music, poetry, film, literature, can best bridge the gap of the disconnect you are discussing? Well, let's relate it to what we've been talking about in terms of intelligence and wisdom. What role can the creative arts play in that?
Well, I had a big win when I was running the State Arts Council for Jerry Brown in his first term. And one of the things that we had a board of all working artists, and one of the things we agreed on was that the arts are basically a creative problem-solving mechanism, that all arts sort of work the same way. You make a line, you write a sentence, you make a movement on impulse. Then you step back and you adjudicate it, and you see what the implications of what you've done are, and you do it again, and you do it again, and you create a map. And one of the things we learned was that it's a combination of both left and right hemisphere brain processes. So the left hemisphere controls the right side of the body, and that's kind of single-pointedness. If you look at your finger's in focus, everything else is out of focus. And that's kind of where logic and digital processes are. And the right side of the brain does analog. It's hearing. You can hear the traffic outside. You can hear me. You can hear rustling in the room. And what an artist does is put both together. It takes digital skills to learn scales, and then it takes feeling to express them. And we convinced the legislature that the artists in the culture were a reservoir of creative problem solvers, and we created relationships with 14 departments of state and sent artists into schools, senior citizen centers, prisons, had dancers working with senior citizens, made films on teenage pregnancy with kids, employing them to do it. And in each of these cases, you could track the results, and you found out that the artists were a kind, you didn't have to be a great artist to teach this process. And even though the pupils or the people that you were teaching might not grow up to be artists, they would have an experience where they were doing something with the totality of their being, and they would never forget it. And it would be a kind of high watermark standard for when they went on to be a lawyer or a doctor or a plumber or a real estate person. And we convinced the legislature that you could be a mediocre anything and do everything by the book, but you couldn't be great unless you could integrate your logic and your intuitions. And that's the way in which I think that art is this invisible agency of healing in the culture, but we don't recognize it for what it can actually do.
Have you heard of The Crack in the Cosmic Egg by Joseph Chilton Pierce? What are your thoughts on his theory of language? Are you familiar with that book?
No.
Okay, next question.
Got past that one.
You always run that risk. What do you consider the most... Oh, wait, we've gone through this stack, so I'm ready for more. If we've got more, we'll also be taking your questions here in just a little bit. We have a chance to talk about this a little bit too. We were talking backstage about this, and I guess this ties to intelligence and wisdom as well, but the whole idea, and I don't know if we're seeing this growing in popularity or if I just see it with the people I hang out with, but a return to the sense of community. And not just being an individual, you know, working in your cubicle, being alone out there, but be it, you know, your biological family or just people you've surrounded yourself with, using that to make your life better.
Well, we talked about this backstage. I said to Peter that had I been able to get free education for my children and medical insurance, I'd still be living on communes. Because I think it's an optimal way of life. You had men and women to work with every day. We played music together every night. We worked really hard. We had people to help with the children when you got tired or sick. We played card games, Monopoly, Risk, what have you. And I think that people are beginning to rediscover the importance of community in the midst of an increasing corporatization and homogenization of culture. I think people are remembering that it's been our birthright for at least 250,000 years. Before there were even tribes, there were small families and clans and extended families, and that's the way human beings evolved.
And we were talking about this woman in Berkeley, Annie Leonard, who put out The Story of Stuff. I'm not sure if any of you are familiar with her, but she is a person, she and four of her close friends bought 5 consecutive homes in Berkeley and tore down all the fences, and they've created this community. And I guess, at least in her case, it's working for her.
Oh, I know a number of people who've done this. The great San Francisco artist Ruth Asawa has almost an entire city block in the Castro where her children have moved in and bought houses, taken all the fences down. A friend of mine who's a Balinese shadow puppet master has done the same thing in San Francisco. Intentional communities are growing up because, you know, one super refrigerator and one stove can take care of 10 people. So a number of people are building big communal kitchens with a big Servel refrigerator and stove. Then they have their little houses and hot plates for privacy and stuff, but a big meeting house if they want to get together. And it's much, much cheaper, and everybody cooperates. And you have multi-generational communities. You have young people and old people. It's a great way to live.
Well, and it's not a coincidence that this woman doing it in Berkeley put out this video and this book, The Story of Stuff, this idea of sharing things as well, because the idea is that we don't need a ton of stuff in our lives. And I guess that kind of gets into the whole intelligence and wisdom thing as well, maybe simplifying things, you know, the whole meditating and just making things simpler.
I think so, but it's really hard. You know, we're surrounded by billions and billions and billions of dollars of very subtle and suggestive advertising that transmits status information to us all the time, that you're not living up to your potential unless you're carrying an Hermes bag or the right sneakers or whatever it is. And it's so ubiquitous that I don't know anyone that's completely exempt from it. Even if you run away from it, you're bringing it all with you. So I think that the next generation of culture heroes are going to be those people that manage to do jujitsu with social status and make living elegantly and simply with less high status. And because the dirty little secret of the environmental movement is that there's nothing about our culture that's sustainable. You can't use the amount of calories per person in our culture and survive. You can't buy your way to a green future. And yet no one wants to go into squalor. No one wants to go back to the Stone Age. So what's required is to learn how to be elegant in the sense that a mathematical formula is elegant, or in the sense that a Zen Buddhist meditation hall or a tea ceremony hall is elegant. And those are going to be personal decisions. They're not going to be huge collective decisions. And if we do that individually, we will wind up leading the culture instead of following it.
We're starting to get a few questions here related to what you've already been saying here today, and I'll get to those in a second. I kind of like this one, which I'm going to paraphrase a little bit here, but if you could tell somebody, if you could advise them to take one college course, what would that one college course be? And would you teach it?
Well, I'm not sure I would tell anyone to take a college course unless their avocation required a skill that they could only learn in college. I mean, we sent all of our kids out and we taught them, oh, computers are going to be the next best thing. We've got to get a computer. Well, the only people that are working today are plumbers and guys who can repair air conditioning and mechanics and do, you know, refurbish your house and do construction. So, and you don't need to go to college to do that. And you don't need to go into debt to hundreds of thousands of dollars. If you're going to be a doctor, if you're going to be a microbiologist, if you're going to be a botanist, I'd say you need to go to college. But I think that we've used college as a kind of ticket to a high status, middle class life. And we send our kids there to booze drink and, you know, binge drink and act crazy, have a good time away from home, like a holding tank between home and the real world. But I'm not sure how much education actually takes place.
All right. Can I take exception to that a little bit?
Sure.
No, what about, well, I've got two kids in college right now, but also, what about the idea though that college, teaches you to think? It's also socialization, first time away from home. But, you know, philosophy courses, things like that, do those have no merit?
No, I think anything has merit if your intention is to learn. But, you know, my son who said to me the other day, he said, oh, my God, I just wasted my time in college. If I'd known what the world was, now that he's out in New York looking for a job. So, you know, life will teach you to think. Life is really hard for the stupid. And if... if you make enough mistakes, you'll learn to think.
This kind of gets back to a question I was sort of asking earlier. Excluding infinite wisdom, how would anything get invented, created, et cetera? So again, you know, this idea of if people take the time to think about everything involved with what they're doing, would stuff not get done?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean. I mean, the human mind is an essentially playful image-generating organ. You know, it just is like clouds changing place and creating images. So people will always do things. They might not do it with internal combustion engines. You know, the guy that invented the Ram pump, which is a little mechanical pump that you can put at the bottom of a 15-foot drop of water, and it will pump water 40 feet high. It doesn't require gasoline. It doesn't require petroleum and refining and stuff like that. So there's a lot of stuff to be invented. The question is, if we're gonna run our culture on hydrocarbons, we're going to increase the temperature of the planet and the oceans and acidify the lakes, and we're eventually going to pollute ourselves out of a home.
Okay. Well, this person also wants to, and not necessarily challenge you on this, but just more of an explanation.
Be polite.
Peter, if every innovation has a shadow side, should we stop all innovation? If the USA stops innovating and other countries do, and they will, it won't be shadow side, it will be dark side. Yes or no? Your thoughts.
Well, that's got so much in it.
All right,
so,
let's break it down here. Okay, so let's start with the first question.
Yeah, I know what the first question is.
Should we stop all innovation?
No, of course we shouldn't. But, like, here's an example. Suppose you're going to build a factory. And I say to you, well, before you build the factory, you might want to look at where you're going to build a factory, and we might want to decide the best place to build a factory, and we might want to consult with the other species that live there. And the people that do that are shamans. And they go out there, and they will check the place out. There are plenty of places to build a factory. There are probably even plenty of places to build nuclear power plants, but not over geologic faults. So taking cognizance of the shadow side doesn't mean stop creating and stop thinking. It means expand your thinking to include more variables. So that's the first half. But the second half, the assumption that if the United States is not leading the world in the production of widgets, that we're going to dissolve back into some kind of middle age ignorance it's primitive thinking. You know, the fact that we could refine our standard of living and do more with less and become elegant would also mean that we're wasting less, that we're far more efficient. And we might be creating the model for places like India and China to emulate us without having to go through the entire industrial revolution and all those polluting mistakes.
I love this next question. If the government were to value wisdom along with intelligence, who would you like to see be the head of the Central Wisdom Agency?
The Dalai Lama.
And if he turned it down, would you take the job?
Not on your life.
What would you suggest to a wave? Oh, okay. That is the word. What would you suggest to a wave who wishes to connect with the ocean?
Open your eyes. You're already in the ocean. The idea, Buddha said that all people are enlightened. The problem is that they don't believe it. And so what meditation does is it gives you the evidence. So the wave that doesn't see that it's connected to the ocean is asleep, but it doesn't change the fact of its connectedness. And a person who doesn't feel connected to the rest of the universe is asleep, but it doesn't change the essential fact of their interdependence.
Now, I know you've got some thoughts on this next question because we were talking about it earlier. Can you speak to the phenomenon of Facebook, et cetera, and isolation and the loss of human energetic connection?
Well, a lot of people have talked about this. I go on Facebook for 5 minutes a day. I check my kids. I check some old friends and stuff. But, again, you have to remember that a virtual community doesn't bring you soup when you're sick, and it doesn't bury you when you're dead. And having 500 or 5,000 friends on Facebook is a kind of virtual community. And one of the shadow sides of it may be that it's easier to sit in front of your computer and work in a bloodless, sweatless, tearless, tension-free, anonymous reality than it is to be out with your neighbors and trying to solve concrete problems and wrestle with egos and personalities and stuff like that. So it's not like it's wrong. It's just you have to be aware that there's a shadow side and to try to keep it in balance and shine light on the shadows.
As we sit here today with you trying to promote wisdom, do you feel like you're just kind of shouting into the abyss?
Or yeah.
Not that I'm calling you an abyss here. It's one thing to sit in a nice room like this and have people listen, and many are nodding their heads. But do you feel the words getting out or not?
Well, I'm not promoting wisdom. Wisdom is a fact of human existence. It's a common denominator of human existence. If I'm doing anything, I'm reminding people that they have this little voice that will tell them what's right and what's wrong and what's the best thing to do if they calm down a little and listen to it. And I think if they do, it doesn't require any promotion. It begins to pay off in terms of relaxation and a deep sense of joy and a sense of contentment. And solves a lot of problems.
At this point, I'd like to remind our radio audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest is actor, narrator, and author Peter Coyote. I'm Peter Finch, a reporter and anchor for KGO Radio, and your moderator for tonight's discussion. Within just a couple of minutes here, those of you who wish to ask a question of, and I was going to say Mr. Coyote again, Peter, I'll ask you to line up at the microphone there, and we'll be able to do that. That'll be within about 5 minutes here, just so you know that that's coming up. A little bit more about just all the different things you've done and everything that's so varied. Has there been something that has been the most rewarding thing for you in your career, everything you've done?
I think having children. Having children and writing my first book. Children are sort of, they're more than you can handle. It takes everything you know and then some. I had a friend back in the day named Terry Cuddy, and Terry Cuddy was caught robbing a Safeway store with a butcher knife. It was a fruitless act. But anyway, at his trial, the judge sentenced him to 9 years in San Quentin, and he said, "Oh, my God, Your Honor, I can't do that much." And the judge said, "Do what you can, Mr. Cuddy. We'll take care of the rest." So I think of children like that, you know. There's nobody got a rule book. Nobody is prepared. But if you tackle it, it takes everything you have and then some. But by God, somewhere around 20, you sort of lose them for a period of time. But around 20, you start to see the people that you'd hope they would be. And my children continue to be an education for me. I don't pretend to be a great parent. My daughter became a PhD psychologist after life with me. I was a single parent for a long time. That and writing a book. The first time I opened up a box of books, and there was this book, and it's the book that's out there tonight has been in print for 15 years. I just finished my second one. And especially because I'm an actor and I can't do anything without 80 people. You know, I go on a film set, there's other actors, there's lights, there's costumes, there's this and that. But when I write, it's just me and my mind and my computer. And at the end of the day, it's as close as I get to a pure expression.
Why'd you write it? Did somebody say, "You got to write a book," or did you say it to yourself? Or?
No, I said it to myself because the 60s and have been so misrepresented. There was a conscious decision when Reagan came into office to end the generation of quarrelsome, querulous, investigative political students. And they set out to define my generation as a bunch of losers in bell-bottom pants and big clunky peace symbols. And they steered all those kids into material possessions. And that's where, you know, Wall Street began to grow up and the dot-com and the kind of consumption culture that we live in today. And I wanted a shot at explaining it to my children. Through my own eyes and the eyes of the people that participated, who were really visionaries. And although we made a lot of mistakes, we played for keeps, we went for broke, and you learn a lot. And I wanted to transmit those lessons as a partisan, not as a victim. You know, the victors get to write history. And so I wanted to take it on and write my own history.
I've got a question for you. Among documentary filmmakers, you're kind of seen as a go-to guy in terms of narrating a lot of these documentaries. Will you only narrate a documentary that you believe in or that you believe in what it's about?
Documentaries, yeah. I mean, Lenny Bruce once said, you know, if they'll pay me $1,000 to play the London Palladium and $1,001 to play the Christian Science Reading Room, I'm at the Christian Science Reading Room. But documentaries are a particular love of mine. It's like a little master's degree in everything. And I've been lucky to do so many with Ken Burns. And I'm on every documentary maker's sucker list. They come to me and, you know, if it's something I like, I'll do it for nothing. And I'll make a deal saying, well, if you sell it, then I'll take a fee. And yeah, I mean, once I got tricked, I said I would do something, and halfway through I realized that this was an odious script. And so, I'm a little more careful. But, I love documentaries, and since they're not paying me, why do something I don't agree with?
We've got a few more written questions here, and at this point, I would also like to invite anyone who would like to actually ask a question of Peter Coyote to make your way over to the microphone there. We'll get a little line going, and we'll start doing that here momentarily. Right now, though, this question. The Diggers made a unique contribution to the 60s. Did they stay loosely in touch over time? Did they continue? Did they change their way of contributing to community, and where are they now?
So for many of you that don't know, the Diggers was an anarchist group that I was a founder of and member of, co-founder, I should say. And we took as our task imagining a world that we wanted to live in and making it real by acting it out. So we wanted to live in a world with free food. We fed 600-700 people a day for nothing. We had free stores. We had free medical clinics. We had free crash pads. And we did that for a number of years, not necessarily as an actual alternative economy, but to demonstrate the power of the imagination. Whereas much of the social thinking of the 60s was leftist, socialist, and communist, we were all artists, and we didn't want to be stuck having to do plays about heroic elevator operators or bus drivers. We wanted to live in a culture where we could be authentic. And so we did everything anonymously, and we did everything for free. After a while, it started to feel like we were running soup kitchens, and the Diggers sort of evolved, and we merged with other collective families and became something called the Free Family. And we became strings of communes all around Northern California, Oregon, Washington, Southern Utah, and Colorado. And, yeah, we're in loose touch. I'm in touch with kids and grandkids and most of my friends, although we've adapted, they have not sold out their principles. One of the things that we learned was that the idea of a counterculture was not such a great idea because it condemned you to marginality. There were a lot of people that we could have made alliances with, but they didn't really want to be around wild men and women with feral children practicing group sex and taking drugs. They were regular Americans. They wanted a square deal. They wanted a better shot in life, and we could have had those people available to us if we hadn't been quite so set on creating a culture from scratch. So our kids have learned that lesson, and, you know, my daughter wears lipstick and high heels and dances all night, but she also works with, condemned criminals and with foster children, and a lot of our kids have become nurses and healers and environmentalists and psychologists, and I'm proud of them. And there were some casualties because we made some mistakes.
I believe we have a question from the audience.
Peter, I had the opportunity to say hello to you this evening, and after I did that, I started reading your book, and I have to tell everyone here, it's fascinating. My question for you is, it looks like you
She's
had...
She's my agent.
My question for you is, you've had such an amazing life, especially in your youth and talking about the communes and everything. Is there anything that you did that you regret?
Yeah. Two things in particular. I really hurt my health by shooting hard drugs. I was a heroin addict for a long time. But even more so, I didn't fully understand the power and the charisma I had over younger people. And while I can say that I didn't give them drugs, I never hid my own behavior from them. And a number of them died imitating me. And that's something that I live with forever. Yeah. And the only thing I can do with it is kind of pay it forward.
Thank you. Great answer. Anyone else want to come up and ask a question?
And while he makes his way over there, let me ask you this question. The general feeling is that the U.S. government is now bought and paid for. Care to comment?
I agree. You know, I think we live in a corporatocracy. And until we decide that the business of politics is too important to let the corporate sector pay, and we choose to pay for our elections ourselves and demand the right of free airtime and take money out of the system and get a system a little more like Europe, where their election cycle is 6 weeks long, and for 6 weeks the candidates go on every single station and debate and ask each other questions, we're never going to create a system where money becomes less important. We give people the keys to the public treasury. What an opportunity to get rich. And in my lifetime, I've watched America turn from a global model to basically a third world country, and it breaks my heart.
We have another question from the audience.
Thank you. Peter, I love your work, and I'm fascinated by the history of San Francisco and your history in it. And I'm thinking about the state of the world today, which concerns me, concerns all of us probably. And the best way for me to put my question, given your genuine connection with the 60s and your long life, is perhaps this way, which is to ask, what would John Lennon do if he were alive today? Because I see, I think about the dream of the 60s, and I compare that to what's going on today. And I don't know if I'm not looking in the right places, but I don't see nearly enough passionate voices speaking out and just basically demanding change.
What would your voice say? I'm not lonesome for any heroes. I knew John Lennon. The Grateful Dead gave me and the Diggers tickets to go over and meet the Beatles and check them out. And he was a wonderful artist. I saved him from getting his teeth knocked out by the Hell's Angels. But I'd say if you miss a passionate voice, your own voice is asking to be recognized. And you don't need John Lennon. You need to figure out what is your unique perspective on the world and honor it and say what it is that you see. And then I don't think you'll be lonesome for John.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Someone wants to know about the documentaries you've done voiceovers for. Do you have a favorite or any favorites among those?
Oh, my God. You know, I've done, you said 70 films. I've done 120-something films, and I've done more than that in documentaries. But I would say that maybe my favorites are Ken Burns. I've been so blessed. I've done five or six. Some of them aren't even out yet. But he's so thoughtful. He's so gifted. He's so wide-ranging. And the two of us work together really effortlessly. And to find that match has been a great gift to me.
How does narrating a documentary differ, well, from being in a movie where you're playing a character? But, I mean, what is the key to being a good documentary narrator? You work with the director. They tell you the kind of read they want. Or do you just look at it and make it as conversational as possible?
Well, both, actually. I'll tell you a story about Ken Burns, which is funny. When he asked me to do the national parks, I said, okay. So he said, well, I'll send you the DVDs of the photos, and I'll send you the scripts, and you can go over it. And I said, oh, no, don't bother. I don't read them, and I don't look at them. He said, oh, no. You have to do that because you don't know how impeccable I am. I said, well, you don't know how good I am. So he said, well, okay, I'm gonna cut aside 3 weeks in New York so we can do this. I said, well, what are there, 6 2-hour episodes? I said, no, we'll get it done in a week, and we won't work past 3 o'clock any day. So I got there, and that's exactly what happened. So the reason I don't read it, and the reason that I don't formulate and work out effects and techniques, is I try to do it like jazz. So the first time I see it, I get really clear images in my mind. And I just imagine that I'm telling a story to somebody. And if I make a mistake, which is rare, tape is cheap and I can go back and do it. But after a while, I think from just reading thousands and thousands of books, usually by the second or third sentence, I have a kind of instinct of the rhythm of the writer. And it's just, I don't know how I do it actually, but I have this ability to know where the sentence is going and know where it's going to be an appositional phrase or where it's going to be a period. And if I had read it, I would just be bored because I would know that there's 60 pages coming. Oh my God, we haven't gotten to Teddy Roosevelt yet. So I prefer to just do it right there in the studio and take it right off my feelings like a jazz player.
As we start to wind down here a bit, I want to get to another question.
Are you getting tired?
Oh, I could go on for hours here, but the broadcast is not infinite. We do have a question here, though, and I do kind of want to start bringing it back to the intelligence and wisdom angle here. So is wisdom defined as looking at the shadow side of every innovation and action?
Well, that would be a diminished definition. But I think it's, in practice, that's true. I think what wisdom is understanding that any time we think in language and exclusive images, we're only covering half the equation, and to try to invite the full picture, which you usually can't do in an everyday mind. You usually need to quiet down a little bit. And then once you do that, then you can keep an outrigger into that shadow side. I call it the shadow, but not all shadows are negative. I mean, the relative is the shadow of the universal, and the universal is the shadow of the relative. And as long as you're in one and you keep an outrigger in the other, you're not excluding anything.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we do have time for only one last question, and it's fairly succinct, but I look forward to your answer. Do you believe in good and bad?
Well, not really. I believe in awake and asleep. I think that if there's the fundamental insight of Buddha is that there's no fixed self. There's no little acorn of Peter Coyote tucked under the liver or behind the lobe of the lung. That it's, it's like if you put 5 dots on a piece of paper, you could not see a pattern. And so the self is kind of implied when you have a body, form, feeling, impulse, sensation, and consciousness. There's some awareness that's aware of all of it. And we call that the self. But we can't find it. It doesn't have a color. It doesn't have a shape. And it doesn't have a location. And so when things don't have a shape, a color, a location, we say they don't actually exist. And yet we all have this feeling of a self, of an independence. So if there's not a fixed self, it's hard for me to believe that there's a fixed good and a fixed bad or a fixed evil. Buddhism is not a dualistic system. Christianity, Judaism, Islam are dualistic systems. But once you have the idea of a monism, an entirely interdependent universe, good is relative to bad. Bad is relative to good. So I don't believe they have like a fixed, independent existence.
And like I say, we could go another hour, but we don't have the time. Our thanks to actor, narrator, author, and Zen Buddhist priest Peter Coyote for sharing his wisdom with us this evening. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and internet. I'm Peter Finch, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That was great.